They arrived with suitcases held together by twine and degrees that the new world refused to recognize. For decades, our people were seen only as labor. We were the hands that cleaned the hospitals in London and the backs that carried the crates in Brooklyn. But by the 1980s, the math began to change. Survival turned into presence. Presence turned into a voting bloc. In the corridors of Washington, London, and Ottawa, the Caribbean diaspora stopped asking for permission to exist. We started to demand a say in how the world treated our home islands. This is not a story of longing or nostalgia. It is a story of cold, hard leverage. It is the history of how a migrant population became a geopolitical force. Our history is no longer contained by the shores of the archipelago. It is being written in the ballot boxes of the North. The influence was earned in blood and sweat. Now it is being cashed in. Chapter 1. The Voting Bloc. The 1980s in the United States were defined by a shift from the individual to the collective. In cities like New York and Miami, the Caribbean population reached a critical mass that the local political machines could no longer ignore. Before this era, the immigrant experience was largely silent. You worked. You sent money home. You stayed out of the way of the police. But the 1980s brought a new kind of pressure. The Cold War was playing out in our backyard. Grenada was invaded in 1983. Jamaica was a focal point of ideological struggle. The people living in Flatbush and Little Haiti realized that if they did not speak up in America, their families back home would pay the price in blood and poverty. The power began with the census. As the numbers of Jamaicans, Guyanese, Trinidadians, and Haitians climbed, the maps of congressional districts began to look different. In New York, the Caribbean American Chamber of Commerce and Industry was formed in 1985. It was not just about business. It was about creating a central nervous system for political funding. When a candidate for mayor or governor wanted the Caribbean vote, they had to go through the community leaders first. This was the birth of the voting bloc. It was a realization that our history in the United States was moving from the kitchen to the courthouse. In Florida, the dynamic was even more intense. The Cuban American National Foundation, or CANF, was established in 1981. This organization changed the rules of the game. They did not just lobby for better schools. They lobbied for a specific type of foreign policy. They proved that a diaspora could hold the keys to the White House. If you wanted to win Florida, you had to speak to the concerns of the Caribbean exile. This created a template for other groups. The Haitian community in Miami began to organize against the disparate treatment of refugees. They saw how the Cuban community was embraced while they were turned away at sea. The struggle for equal protection under the law became a political firestorm that forced the Reagan administration to answer difficult questions. The grit of this period was found in the basement meetings and the community radio stations. These were the places where the strategy was set. It was not always polite. There were deep divides between different island groups. There were class tensions between the professional class and the laborers. But the external pressure of the 1980s forced a functional unity. The United States was a place of opportunity, but it was also a place of systemic exclusion. To break the exclusion, the diaspora had to become a singular entity at the ballot box. By the middle of the decade, the phrase Caribbean American started to carry weight in the halls of power. This was not about assimilation. It was about leverage. When the United States government considered trade policies or military interventions in the region, they had to account for the millions of voters who still had one foot in the islands. The diaspora became a bridge. They were the ones who explained the reality of the Caribbean to a Washington establishment that often saw the region only as a map of potential threats. They used their status as citizens to protect the sovereignty of their birthplaces. It was a sophisticated exercise in dual identity. The stakes were high because the consequences were immediate. A change in immigration law in Washington meant a family in Kingston was separated. A shift in trade tariffs meant a farmer in St. Lucia went hungry. The diaspora understood this connection perfectly. They were the first generation to realize that being a good American citizen meant being a fierce advocate for the Caribbean. They began to run for local office. They became district leaders and city council members. They learned the language of the machine so they could dismantle the parts that ground our people down. But power is never given without a struggle. The rise of the Caribbean voting bloc in the 1980s met with significant resistance. There were attempts to gerrymander districts, to dilute our influence. There were smear campaigns against leaders who refused to toe the party line. The community had to develop a thick skin. They had to learn how to play the long game. They traded their votes for specific promises. They demanded infrastructure in their neighborhoods and fair treatment for their home countries. By the end of the 1980s, the foundation was laid. The Caribbean diaspora was no longer a guest in the United States. It was a stakeholder. The old guard of the political establishment found themselves sitting across the table from people who spoke with the accents of the islands, but held the power of the American vote. The leverage was real. The influence was growing. But as the decade closed, a new question emerged. Could this power be sustained when the interests of the diaspora clashed with the interests of the American state? The transition from 1989 to 1990 marked a period of uncertainty. The Cold War was ending, and the strategic importance of the Caribbean was being reassigned. The diaspora had to prove that their value was not just as a tool against communism. They had to prove they were a permanent fixture of the American political landscape. The fight was shifting from the streets to the policy papers. The pressure was mounting. At the same time, the home islands were watching. They saw the power their cousins were wielding in the north. They began to reach out. They started to see the diaspora not just as a source of money, but as a political weapon. This created a new kind of tension. Who did the diaspora represent? Were they Americans of Caribbean descent, or were they the external wing of Caribbean political parties? The answer would determine the future of the region. The stage was set for a confrontation between the old world and the new. Our history shows that when the diaspora speaks with one voice, the world listens. But finding that voice is a process of friction. The 1980s provided the friction. The 1990s would provide the test. The voting bloc was a weapon. The next step was learning how to aim it. As the decade turned, a major shift in immigration policy was proposed in Washington that threatened to cut the lifeline between the islands and the mainland. Chapter 2: The Siege of Institutions. The United Kingdom in the early 1980s was a pressure cooker. For the Caribbean community, the dream of the mother country had long since curdled into a reality of police harassment and economic stagnation. The Windrush generation had built the hospitals and driven the buses, but their children were being treated as an invading force. The tension broke in 1981. In Brixton, the streets turned into a battlefield. It was called a riot by the press, but for our people, it was an uprising. It was a response to Operation Swamp 81, where the police used stop and search powers to target black men with surgical precision. The smoke over Brixton was a signal. It told the British establishment that the Caribbean community would no longer accept being a permanent underclass. This was the grit of the UK experience. It was not about lobbying in plush offices. It was about holding the line in the streets. The violence was a symptom of a deep systemic exclusion. The response from the government was the Scarman Report, which acknowledged the racial disadvantage, but fell short of calling the police institutionally racist. The community knew better. They knew that if they did not capture the institutions would continue to crush them. The shift from the street to the parliament was forced by the 1985 Broadwater Farm uprising in Tottenham. Another eruption of anger followed the death of Cynthia Jarrett during a police search. The stakes had reached a breaking point. The Caribbean diaspora in Britain realized that protesting from the outside was a slow death. They needed to be inside the room where the laws were made. This led to the historic 1987 general election. For the first time, three black Caribbean politicians were elected to the House of Commons: Bernie Grant, Diane Abbott, and Paul Boateng. Their entry into Parliament was a siege. They were not welcomed with open arms. They were met with icy stares and a press that scrutinized their every move. Bernie Grant, who had been a leader in the Haringey Council, refused to wear the standard suit of the establishment on all occasions. He spoke for the working class and the migrant. Diane Abbott became a voice for the Caribbean woman, fighting a dual battle against racism and sexism. They were the bridgeheads. They proved that the diaspora could not just influence the vote, they could hold the office. But the institution had a way of fighting back. The 1990s and early 2000s saw the rise of the hostile environment policy. It was a slow-moving bureaucratic war against the Windrush generation. People who had lived in the UK for 50 years, who had paid taxes and raised families, were suddenly being told they were illegal immigrants. This was the ultimate betrayal. The very people who had been invited to rebuild Britain were being discarded. The diaspora had to pivot from seeking power to defending their basic right to exist. The Windrush scandal, which broke into the public consciousness later, was the result of decades of institutional neglect. The diaspora's political power was tested like never before. They had to mobilize a national campaign to force the government to apologize and compensate the victims. This was not a fight for a new policy, it was a fight for the truth of our history. The Caribbean leaders in the UK used their positions in the media and in Parliament to expose the cruelty of the Home Office. They showed that the diaspora was not a guest that could be evicted. It was a fundamental part of the British fabric. The influence in the UK was different from the US. In Britain, it was about class and the survival of the welfare state. The Caribbean community were the staunchest defenders of the National Health Service because they were the ones who staffed it. Their political power was rooted in their labor. When they threatened to withdraw that labor or use their collective voice to shame the government, the state was forced to listen. The UK diaspora learned that in a parliamentary system, the margin of victory is often thin. The black vote, in key urban constituencies, became the decider in many elections. However, the cost of this influence was high. The pioneers of this movement faced constant threats and character assassination. To be a Caribbean political leader in London was to be under a microscope. Every mistake was magnified. Every success was minimized. But they stayed. They stayed because they knew that without their presence, the hostile environment would have claimed even more victims. They were the shield for the community. By the turn of the millennium, the Caribbean presence in British politics was no longer a novelty. It was a necessity. But a new complication was emerging. The younger generation, born and raised in the UK, had a different relationship with the islands. They were British, but they were also Caribbean. They had to navigate a world that still struggled to accept that duality. They began to use the digital age to connect their struggles in London with the struggles in Kingston and Port of Spain. The political power was becoming global. The question of the menu versus the witness became central. Was having a few MPs enough to change the systemic racism of the British state? Or were they just witnesses to a system that continued to marginalize their people? The tension between the radicals and the reformists within the diaspora grew. The grit was no longer just between the community and the state. It was within the community itself. They were debating the best way to use the influence they had spent 40 years building. The battle for the institutions was far from over. As the UK moved toward Brexit, the Caribbean diaspora found itself caught in a new wave of nationalism. The stakes were being reset once again. The power they had built was being challenged by a new political reality that threatened to undo the progress of the last four decades. The siege was ongoing. The next theater of influence was opening in the north, where a different model of migration and power was taking shape in the snowy streets of Toronto. Chapter 3: The North Star's Shift. Canada often presents a face of multicultural harmony, but the Caribbean diaspora in Toronto knows the grit beneath the surface. In the 1990s, the neighborhood of Eglinton West, known as Little Jamaica, became the front line for a different kind of political struggle. Unlike the overt battles in London or the lobbyist wars in Washington, the Canadian experience was about the slow capture of municipal and federal influence through community organization. The Caribbean community in Canada, largely comprised of Jamaicans, Trinidadians, and Guyanese, realized that the mosaic only worked if you fought for your piece of it. The power shift in Toronto began with the realization that the Caribbean community was the economic engine of many parts of the city. They weren't just workers, they were homeowners, entrepreneurs, and taxpayers. In the 1990s, the push for representation reached the Parliament in Ottawa. Figures like Jean Augustine, the first black woman elected to the House of Commons in 1993, changed the landscape. Her presence was not just symbolic. She was the one who pushed for the official recognition of Black History Month in Canada. This was about more than a calendar. It was about the state acknowledging that our history was Canadian history. But the real influence of the Canadian diaspora was felt back in the islands. This is where the concept of the North Star shifted. Toronto became a secondary capital for the Caribbean. The money sent home, in the form of remittances, became a larger part of the island economies than foreign aid, or even tourism in some years. This gave the diaspora a unique form of leverage. They weren't just voting in Canada, they were funding the politics of the Caribbean. In the 1990s and 2000s, dual citizenship became a major political tool. The diaspora, in Canada and the US, began to demand a say in the governance of their home islands. If they were the ones keeping the economy afloat during hurricanes and financial crashes, why shouldn't they have a vote? This created a massive tension. The leaders on the islands feared the influence of the foreigners who didn't have to live with the daily consequences of their votes. The diaspora, meanwhile, felt they were being treated as nothing more than a bank account. The role of the diaspora as a tool for regime change became evident in several Caribbean elections. Political parties began to campaign in Toronto and Brooklyn as heavily as they did in Kingston. They knew that a phone call from a cousin in Canada could sway a dozen votes in a rural village back home. The diaspora became the largest, most informed, and most critical voting bloc for the islands. They used their exposure to Canadian and American democratic standards to demand more transparency and less corruption from their home governments. This influence was a double-edged sword. It brought much-needed resources and ideas, but it also created a sense of resentment. The brain drain that had taken the best and brightest to the north was now returning in the form of political pressure. The diaspora had to learn how to exercise their power without being seen as imperialists. They had to prove that their commitment to the islands was genuine and not just a way to relive a past they had left behind. In Toronto, the struggle was also local. The construction of the Eglinton Crosstown LRT threatened to wipe out Little Jamaica. The businesses that had been the soul of the community for 40 years were being boarded up. The political power of the diaspora was put to the test. Could they save their own neighborhood? The mobilization against the transit project showed a new level of sophistication. They used data, social media, and direct political lobbying to force the city to recognize the cultural significance of the area. It was a fight for the physical memory of the migration. The impact of the diaspora is now a permanent factor in Caribbean geopolitics. When a crisis hits the region, the first response often comes from the community organizations in the north. They are the first responders, the primary investors, and the most vocal advocates. They have forced the governments of the US, UK, and Canada to pay attention to the Caribbean, not as a playground, but as a region of strategic and human importance. However, the cost is a permanent state of displacement. The diaspora lives in a third space, not fully of the north, and no longer fully of the islands. Their political power is born from this tension. They are the ones who can see the flaws in both systems. They are the ones who have to build a future that bridges the gap. The influence they have built is a legacy of survival. It is the result of millions of people refusing to be invisible. As we look at the landscape of 2026, the diaspora's power is at an all-time high. Caribbean-descended politicians hold high offices across the globe. The remittances continue to flow. The cultural influence is undeniable. But the question of who truly governs the Caribbean remains unresolved. Is it the people who live on the soil, or the people who provide the means for that soil to be tilled? The final line of this history is not yet written. The diaspora has moved from the margins to the center. They have seized the institutions and mastered the vote. But the weight of that influence carries a heavy responsibility. The islands are watching. The world is watching. The power is there. The question is what we will do with it. The influence of the diaspora has changed the map of the Caribbean forever. But the price of that power is a debt that the next generation is only beginning to understand.